Hi, this is Sander Wolf, Culture Agents columnist for LB Post, and I'm here with
Chris Lord.
And we're talking about the new CD that's coming out on Sounds Are Active by
Nels Klein and Gene Stinson, Elevating Device.
Elevating Device. And if you don't mind, we're eating pizza and talking at the same time. Maybe you can give me a little background on the label, how it started and what your vision for the label was.
Well, I guess it started almost 10 years ago. Things are getting a little fuzzy now, but I guess around 1998, I started getting together with Create, with my free jazz ensemble, free form ensemble, and we started doing some recording. And I had been doing recordings of my own around that time, and they started multiplying, and I thought it would just be a lot easier for me to put it all out myself rather than try to contact a bunch of different record labels for all this different kind of music.
Well, what kind of different things were you talking about?
Well, I mean, so like Create was more like free, you know, free jazz, or almost like genre-less. I almost kind of think of Create as kind of being able to do almost anything at the spur of the moment. We're sort of like not in control of what ends up coming out. But so there was that. One of the early artists that was involved in the label was Bizart, and his stuff was like spoken word, like hip-hop, poetry. I had some instrumental stuff that was a little bit more like world music, like based around like tabla and kalimba and acoustic guitar. And I was also doing electronic music at the time. Stuff was all programmed on like an old like Roland MC303 groove box. And so then I had some electronic and live stuff together. And it was just sort of all this stuff. And I figured the easiest thing to do is for me to just like slap a bunch of different names on all these projects and then put them out, segment them, and put them all out myself eventually. So I think it was 1999... ended up putting out the first Create record, which was Moth Nor Rust, which was just a couple of live performances.
I mean, which is great. I love that album.
It's about as raw as it can get, you know what I mean? I think it was recorded with two microphones. It's just stereo mics, so there was no mixing involved. It's very raw. I think it was maybe in 2000 that I put out the first Bizart record, which was Everybody's Mouth. And then we ended up putting out records by Soul Junk and some of my solo electric guitar stuff, XN, and from there things just sort of got more and more, the roster of artists just got bigger and bigger. You know, we were putting out hip-hop, free jazz, ambient music, electronic music, rock music, you know, acoustic music. So some of it's good, some of it's not so good.
But were these all people that you were just, like, already sort of associated with?
Early on, yeah. I mean, it was kind of interesting. Things were just very organic, you know what I mean? They just happened very naturally. Somebody would hear something, and then they'd be like, oh, wow, like that. I love this kind of stuff. I ended up putting out the first Soul Junk record, 1957, the first Soul Junk record with Sounds Are Active. And that was just as a result of me being a huge fan of Soul Junk. They had put their previous album out with Jackson Rubio, which was Matt Wignall's label, who was in Javelina.
Right.
And then Jackson Rubio went out of business. So Soul Junk, to my knowledge, didn't have another label to put their stuff out with. And then they went with this unbelievably complex, extreme, experimental hip-hop, and it was kind of a perfect fit for... It was so sophisticated, you know? Mm-hmm. I still listen back to those records, and I'm like, I can't believe that stuff came out, you know, 8 years ago or whatever it was. I mean, it was really, truly ahead of its time, you know. And so obviously Soul Junk had a lot of fans of their own, and then some of those people started becoming more familiar with what Sounds Are Active was doing because of Soul Junk's involvement. And then we got, you know, we put out a record with Kevin Robinson, who's in a pretty well-known band called Viva Voce. It was like his hip-hop electronic side project called Electric Ill.
Electric Ill?
Yeah, Electric
nice.
Ill. And then, I don't know, it just seemed like things were just sort of like sort of chugging along. We kept putting out Create records here and there, a couple more Civil Junk records, a couple more BizArt records. I ended up producing Eardrum and co-producing Bloodshot Mama by BizArt. We put out the Jazz, a compilation record with Pete Records, which was
also,
co-release.
I have that too. That's a fantastic... It's a really unique kind of snapshot.
Yeah, of Long Beach. Yeah. You know what I mean? And the kind of... you know, the whole point of that was really to showcase all this music that was hard to classify that was happening in Long Beach. And so on that record alone, you had free jazz improvisation, electronic singer-songwriter music, like Sidecar, like more heavy, like fusion influence stuff, which was the Slippers. There's Crankcase, which was like meter-style instrumental funk, and then Dub Kinetics, which is total dub, live dub, reggae. And then there were some musicians that were kind of crossing over, like Steve Richardson from Create was playing drums in Dub Kinetics, and you know what I mean? There's a lot of kind of back and forth.
Right.
But that was a huge release for Sounds Are Active. I mean, that was one of those... That was, I think, maybe one of the first records that I put out, and I was like, hey, like, got some press attention for this, like... You know, we did it. We Pete Records paid for it to be out on vinyl as well, so it just ended up kind of having a higher level of press attention than anything I'd put out. And so at each step of the way, there's just these small encouragements. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like somebody's like, "Hey, I want to do an interview or I want to do an article." So OC Weekly did an interview with Pete Diebel and I, and then Press Telegram did an interview with Pete Diebel and I, and then. And it was just sort of slowly but surely, you know.
I would like to point out, however, that Long Beach Culture was the first,
I think, first interview I ever did, maybe.
Yeah, with Raquel Ramirez.
That's right.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
I was actually going to mention that. I'm glad that you brought that up, because I think, I mean, that was like support from day one.
Yeah, well, I remember that show. I remember we did it in it was a preview for the show that you did at that place on Broadway.
Oh,
and it was
soon.
Yeah, and it was
I missed that place.
It was a release party, I think, and you guys played, Create played,
mm-hmm.
and it was Sidecar
mm-hmm.
and another group, I can't remember.
I think maybe the Slippers, maybe.
Maybe,
yeah.
Maybe. But, you know, Raquel was really enamored of the work you were doing, and so was I, and I think Create was such an interesting sort of juggernaut, you know, that, like you were saying, that it could, on the turn of a dime, go in like a gazillion different directions.
Yeah.
Just like that, you know.
I learned so much from being in, you know, in that group. I mean, it was really a trial by fire, you know, because I'd come out of playing in this group called the Convergence Ensemble, which was a more conventional instrumental trio, fretless bass, guitar, and drums. And we rehearsed for like a year and played like one show. And then Create was the polar opposite of that. I mean, the first time we ever played together was a show. So it was just a total, you know, it turned that whole convention on its head for me. And I felt like, you know, I would be out there on stage and we were just forced to make decisions, like one after another after another. I mean, I really don't know if people realized, like, we did not practice. We did not talk about stuff. If we were going to try out a tune, we tried it out. Like, I would, you know, one of us would say, like, hey, I got this idea for a head or a melody, like, before the show. You know, just like, hey, let's try it, you know? And everything that happened with that group was just an honest, sometimes embarrassing, sometimes exhilarating, you know, experience.
Well, I think that was part of the excitement of it for listeners and viewers, that idea that you were willing to step out beyond the confines of, you know, safety and just take that kind of creative risk. And I think that people trusted that you guys were, that the audience and the group together were able to take that step together. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think
definitely.
There's something about it. And, you know, again, this is not about me so much, but you know, I remember vividly the recording that you guys did over in San Pedro.
Mm-hmm.
And
The hymn for St. John of Shanghai.
Right. And, you know, it was so funny because I really didn't know what you guys were going to come in with prior to asking you. I just said come and contribute something.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you broke out the acoustic guitar, I nearly fell over. You know, I mean, honestly, because I had never seen you play an acoustic guitar before. I mean, I knew you. I'm sure you had one.
Right.
You know, and when you listen to that recording, I wish I still had a copy of the first take. I don't. But when you listen to that recording, it's like you're taking a breath and you're just letting it out slowly. And it's this beautiful kind of prayer-like thing, which is, and I don't know if you guys rehearsed that at all or...
Not really. I wrote that piece pretty much right before we went into the studio. I wrote the melody and kind of worked out some of the arrangement ideas while we were in the studio. And that was just with a quartet with Peter Chan on clarinet and me on acoustic guitar. I think Andrew Pompey on drums and Orlando on upright. And that was an important recording both for Create and for me personally, because that allowed me to sort of Create was the funny thing about Create was it was no one's group. You know, I said that a lot, but it's true. I mean, it's nobody's group. No one can like corral the group and take it in their whatever direction they want, you know. It really has to just it's something that kind of requires you to humble yourself and say, like, okay, like, I can't control this entirely, you know? So, it kind of informed my approach over the next few years, because if I would have a recording session or something that I wanted to accomplish, I wanted to use Create or the components of Create, you know, different members who played with the group, but in a much more focused context to get something that I wanted instead of the sort of collective experiment, you know. But both things are important, you know, being able to experiment and not be in control, and then to be in total control and articulate, you know. And then you know, not too long after that, I started working on Twilight and Ghost Stories, actually not too long after we did that recording. And obviously that kind of signaled a very different kind of, you know, I guess, approach and sound of what people might know me for, you know.
But the interesting thing about that recording is that it really embodies exactly what you're talking about, where you're fusing, you know, contributions that you had no control over, and you took them as, like, raw material and crafted them into something almost like a you know, a tapestry, weaving all these little elements together into something that no one individual could have ever conceived of or imagined.
Yeah, I was kind of liking Twilight and Ghost Stories and the I Heart Lung Inter Oceans album into these kind of like monoliths, or like these like what a sculptor would do, you know.
Right.
His approach, where you have just this giant rock or stone, and it's all about refining its shape. And you know, obviously if you were to take that approach with, like, you know, trying to sculpt a statue out of sand or salt or something like that, it would decay and deteriorate quickly. But if you can get good material, which is the contributions of all these amazing musicians and artists and thinkers, then you can end up, you know, you can end up creating something hopefully that's worthwhile and has some longevity. I mean, I'm always thinking about, both in my own music and the things that I end up releasing on Sounds Are Active, like, I'm always hoping that there's a certain timeless quality to them. You know what I mean? A certain, you know, it's like, it's the easiest thing to sort of, like, follow along with the stuff that's popular in the day. You can always find those bands, and you can always give them opportunity, and they're always going to take it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because they want to, it's a sort of a, it's an ego thing, you know what I mean? And people always want to be accepted, and they want to kind of be a part of something bigger. And I was just, honestly, I was never, and I still am not interested in that, you know? I just, I just kind of like follow my muse, you know what I mean? I guess for lack of a better explanation.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
I just put out the things that feel good to me. I don't really care if like they're popular or not, and you know, sales be damned. Or
so know. Now let's get back to the project at hand. How did you connect with GE and Nels? How did that come together?
Well, Anthony Shattuck, who's an upright and electric bassist, a fantastic musician, he and I had worked on a number of different projects. I think we were introduced through Lynn Johnston, the horn player, clarinet and saxophone.
Mm-hmm.
And I was introduced to Lynn through Peter Chan, who played with Create. So there's the sort of the connecting the dots there. It goes, it's so like, it's so snake-like, and it's kind of like, and it's sort of in the connections like from one person to another. But so anyhow, I'd worked with Anthony on a number of different projects, and he'd played with Create. He played on the Liz Janes and Create album that I'd produced for Asthmatic Kitty, which is all like public domain songs that I rearranged and got a group together to perform. Anthony had lined up a quartet session with himself on upright bass, Lynn Johnston on clarinet, Chess Smith on drums, and Nels on guitar, on electric guitar. So we ended up recording that at Lynn's house in El Segundo. So I have a mobile recording setup. I do a lot of engineering and producing for different groups and artists. So I took all my stuff, set it up in Lynn's living room, and in about, I don't know, 20 minutes, I had a recording studio in there. And I remember Nels commented, you know, at how quickly I had set everything up. He's like, that's it? I was like, yeah, that's it. He's like, wow, that's some... He made a comment to my ancestry. He's like, oh, that's definitely some German stuff right there, you know? But I ended up producing and engineering that record. Ended up releasing that on Sounds Are Active. You know, I sent Nels a couple copies of it. And Tom Steck from I Heart Lung did the artwork for it. And then... I think not too long after that, I talked to Nels about contributing to the new I Heart Lung album, Inter Oceans. And so we got together and we ended up talking. I think we talked for like 10 or 15 minutes just about like Astor Piazzolla's guitar player. You know, like I was listening to a lot of tango music at the time. He was like, oh man. So, you know, it was just so warm and, you know what I mean, like sincere. And we just had a good session, you know, talking about music. I think he felt really comfortable with like the material, you know.
Yeah.
I think he really was enjoying it, and he was really supportive of it, and it was very encouraging, very heartening for me, because you know, it's obviously somebody I look up to and respect, you know.
He's a monster.
Yeah. And for, you know, and the interesting thing is I don't play with a lot of guitar players too, so that was another thing where I knew he was going to be able to articulate things that I could not. He mm-hmm. was a different voice,
right.
And the sounds of our guitars are so different, too. Like, I play much heavier sounding, like a Les Paul, and his stuff is a lot lighter and kind of, like, a little bit more floaty sometimes, you know, and kind of cutting, and mine's, like, more thuddy, you know. So, we'd done that, and then over time, you know, we just kept in touch, and at some point, he had mentioned that he had this record that he did with GE, and he wanted to know if I'd be interested in hearing it and releasing it. And I said, well, I definitely want to hear it first. You know, I was like, I know you guys are both amazing musicians, but I'm sort of at a point where, you know, I'm cautious enough, no matter who's involved, to say, like, well, let me hear it first. And so I heard it, and obviously it was great. But eventually, you know, I ended up meeting GE through Nels. GE was the one who I think sent me the CDs and whatnot. And since GE was here and Nels was touring all over with Wilco, it was a lot easier for me to just converse with GE about the project at that point. So I sent the recording out to my friend Matthias Koduri, who lives in Argentina. He did the artwork. And it was great because he did the artwork as a response to the music, which mm-hmm. is always my preference. If an artist is going to do something, that they're responding to what
right.
the music is conveying to them.
And the art is actually amazing. I mean,
yeah.
when I saw the cover art on the website,
yeah.
it really
it grabbed me.
Yeah,
it was,
and it's very natural too. Like, it, and it's sort of, you know, kind of coming back to the snake leg. It's sort of serpentine. It's got those little like lines that kind of like snake through the cover, and much like, you know, that how a lot of the music sort of slithers around, like from feeling to genre to idea, you know, to texture. So it was great because I was really able to do kind of like the best case scenario. You know, they give me the music, I give it to a visual artist, the visual artist responds to it, I showed it to Nels and GE, and they were immediately like, that's great. There was no like hemming and hawing over it. It was just like, there it is, you know? Right. So, so yeah, it's actually, the record's at the manufacturing plant right now, and it'll be out in September.
And now, there was more material from that recording session, and according to them, some of it they're quite fond of, and I was just wondering, why not put, it's 40 minutes or 44 minutes or whatever, why not add a second track?
That was their decision. I think I think Nels and GE were thinking that there was probably enough material there to release a volume 2.
Oh, I see.
So, and you know what, I'm a bit of a, I'm sold out for high concept stuff. Like, I can't help it. So I really love the fact that it's just one 40-minute track.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, take it or leave it. You know what
right.
I mean?
Right.
And actually, that's the way Twilight was written, as just one 40-minute piece. But Asthmatic Kitty asked me to chop up the album into different tracks
segments.
To make it a little bit easier for the average person to kind of, like, jump into it, you know? So.
Well, but, I mean, on one level, that's just ridiculous. You know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
You can jump around, and that's great, but
yeah.
It really is one work. It's,
yeah.
It's not snippets of this and snippets of that. It's,
right.
And it, when you listen to it, when you sit down and listen to it, it has that feeling of being cut from whole cloth.
Yeah.
You know? And,
yeah.
And
that's how it was written.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I like the fact that Nels and GE were like, yeah, it's just one 40-minute track. I was like, I can get behind that. You know, so.
And did they come up with a title, or did you?
Yeah, no, they came up with the title. I mean, it was pretty. It was a whole piece that was essentially just given to me. I mean, they had the concept and everything kind of already in place. And Ronan Chris Murphy had done the engineering and production with them on it. And he's a great engineer, so it's like I didn't really have to do any. Usually with a lot of sounds directed projects, I'm involved on some level of audio, you know, like mastering or engineering or recording or playing or something.
Do you do your own mastering? Or do you...
It depends. For Twilight, I sent that down to Rafter Roberts in San Diego, and for Interoceans, I went out to Roger Seibel in Arizona. Sometimes on my own projects, if it's a larger project, I'll try to send it out because I've been working on it from day one, and I always want to have a second set
right.
of ears.
It's hard. It's so easy to get kind of lose all perspective.
Oh man, Interoceans is all about losing perspective. I mixed that record so much; it was insane.
Well, let me ask you a question. You know, I've seen I Heart Lung play a number of times, and the feeling that I got, and maybe this is just my own perception, was that you guys were improvising. Is that largely what you do? I mean,
yeah, there's a lot of improvisation with I Heart Lung, but we do have a lot of melodies, a lot of heads that are pre-written. We have some structural things that are kind of very important to the whole of the performance. So, that's gotten a little bit more sophisticated over the years. You know, as we've had a little bit more time and sort of honed the,
right.
the I guess the vocabulary that we have with one another.
Sure.
But
And then on Interoceans, was that more of a composed project?
It's interesting. It's sort of a parallel because it started out as an improvisation, and over the years, I worked on it with Tom for 3 years. And it got more and more composed. So the four tracks on there basically started out as drones, and then we ended up layering 12-string acoustic guitar. Lynn Johnston played bass clarinet. Nels played, you know, sitar and electric guitar. Anthony Shattuck came in and played upright bass. Andrew Pompei played percussion.
But did you give these people parts, or did they listen to it and come up with their own parts on the spot?
It depended. I mean, for the stuff that, like, Dave Easley, who played Pedal Steel, I basically sent him two tracks, and I just let him do
whatever
thing.
He had.
Yeah. And then when he sent it back to me, I then heavily edited it. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really move anything around chronologically, but I would sort of, like, fade in and out parts as the song started to take shape.
Sure.
You know, kind of going
sure.
back to that sculptural analogy.
Sure.
But yeah, some of the parts were totally written out. Like the stuff for Lynn, like I had him playing bass clarinet and clarinet and doing things that sort of like mimic the sound of like foghorns. Because there were field recordings that Aaron Zim provided for the album. And on some of them you can hear, some of them are from the Maritime Museum in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
And so you can hear these kind of foghorns kind of wafting in and out like at the beginning of track two. And then I had Lynn kind of mimicking those sounds.
Sounds so beautiful. I'm so excited to hear it. I haven't heard it yet. So.
Yeah. I mean, other than Twilight and Ghost Stories, I mean, Inter-Oceans is like the thing that I'm probably most proud of that I've done, of my own music to date. You know?
Well, you know, I have to say that I'm a big fan of the XN album.
Mm.
And I'm frustrated by it sometimes because I wish it was all just your tracks,
yeah.
Like three times as many. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That the remixes are cool,
yeah.
But I honestly, you know, I just would rather hear more of your work.
Sure.
In that context,
I appreciate that.
Because the compositions, the playing, everything about it is just it's perfect little pieces that you created with. Is it just one guitar, basically?
It's, yeah. Yeah, basically. And some loops. That was it.
Yeah, it's a great album. I love it. And like I said...
very lo-fi, actually. I mean, I didn't have any material, like any equipment, really, when I recorded that record.
But the thing is that's even more of a credit to the music itself, because it's a really strong... Compositionally, it's really strong that... The pieces, each of them, have their own unique character. It's not samey, you know, like so many things are, especially when you have like a solo guitar record.
Yeah.
It can feel like, oh, more of this? But, you know, XN really just, each little, it's like a little painting, you know?
Yeah. You know, and I did another XN record with my friend Denair, Victor Rabatinera, and it was... Four solo XN pieces, four solo Denair pieces, and then two collaborative pieces. And that's up on the website. I feel like that is very similar in spirit. I think actually the compositions on there are better than on Ideas Without Numbers. I hope at some point to kind of jump into the solo electric guitar thing again. I really like the limitations of that, and
sure.
I've always liked approaching my guitar with a certain hatred or disdain for what it's capable of. So, you know, I think one of these days I'll get back to, you know, just focusing in on like making, you know, like a 30 or 40 minute. You know, XN doesn't really exist anymore. I'm just going under my own name at this
sure.
point.
Sure, good, good. I think that's a great thing because,
yeah.
you know, I always encourage people to do that.
It took a long time for me, you know, because when I was talking about creating the label, part of the impetus for that was saying, oh, well, you know, I could have all these different projects and I could act like they're a bunch of different groups
right.
or whatever.
Right. Right.
And then it seems like, hey, you have a stable or a roster of artists. And it's like, oh, well, most of them are me. But then at a certain point, I remember I was out on tour with I Heart Lung and Castanets. And I was talking to my friend Ray Raposa from Castanets. Talking to him about Twilight, which I was working on at the time. And he was like, you just need to put it out under your own name. And I was like, oh, I don't know. I kind of was like hemming and hawing, you know. And he just kind of like, he was so certain.
I would have told you exactly the
yeah.
same thing. And I'm
he was like,
he
this
did.
Is your music. He's yeah, like, this yeah. is your piece of music. And that was really sort of a sea change for me. I think because from that point on, I started to have more confidence in like, hey, I mean, it's hard to grow up with confidence with a last name like Schlarb in your name. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, it's a name that rhymes with nothing. There's literally no word in the English language that I
blarb?
Can, yeah, blarb. That, and that's, what is that? Maybe rhubarb?
I don't know. You know what, though? I mean, the thing is, you're an artist. You know, and how many visual artists, you know, that go by some nom de plume or
right.
some other... You're an artist. And I think a lot of musicians really struggle with that. And I'm glad to hear that you've come to that place in your mind and in your heart to really embrace that. Well, I wasn't really planning to talk about this all that much for this, but since we're talking about it anyway, I have to ask you to talk a little bit about playing Twilight live. To me, that just I can't even wrap my mind around that, and I'm just curious if you could talk about that a little bit. You've done it a couple times now, right?
Yeah, so I've done it. I did it in Athens, Georgia. That was the first one. Then I did it in San Francisco, then Austin, Texas, and New York. So I've done four of them now. I'm in the beginning stages of trying to put one together for LA, hopefully before the end of the year.
And are all these recorded?
Okay, they're all recorded except for San Francisco. It was like San Francisco never happened. There's no photographs, no documentation, nothing. And it's a shame because it was really great. I mean, great musicians, really great assembly of instruments. The arrangement of instruments was really neat. Unfortunately, no proof that it ever happened. But... yeah, all the other ones have been recorded. I have a really brilliant recording of the Austin one, and that one was filmed in high definition as well. Nice. I have a recording of the first Athens performance, and that was the one that started everything. I was asked by a guy named Will Donaldson to come out and perform at his festival called the Next to Last Festival in Athens. And it was this really beautiful kind of like outdoor festival of like all these kind of different all of these different artists and musics, you know, like hip hop, noise, jazz, folk, you know what I mean? It was perfect, you know what I mean? Like electronic. And I felt so comfortable. And it was a really high bar of, I mean, the other artists that he had there were like Diane Cluck, who's an astounding singer-songwriter. She's absolutely incredible. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, themselves, which are two of the guys from that band Subtle, who are on the Anticon record label, Daedalus, who's from Los Angeles, electronic artist, and, you know, all these people were coming. Liz James, who, you know, is on Asthmatic Kitty with me, and Spin King. It was like all these amazing people, and it was like, wow. So I basically told Will, I was like, well, if you want me to come out there and do Twilight, or something like that. I'm not going to just come out there and play my acoustic guitar to a track or something. I was like, here's what I'd need. I would need a lighting box that would have switches on it that would allow me to assign different lights to different people in this ensemble. And he's like, okay. And like a week or two later, I get an email with a photograph. And he's like, here's your box. And he actually, with a friend of his, built this beautiful light box that I have at my house. And it's got, and it's totally, I mean, it looks totally steampunk, you know what I mean? It looks totally like, it's like this beautiful combination of futuristic and kind of ancient, you know?
Nice.
And sure enough, you know, on the back, there's all these like light switches basically on the front, and on the back, plugs for lights. And so, the live Twilight performance is about, assembling the right musicians, just like on the record. I try to get as many people who were on the album as possible. So when I did it in Athens, it was kind of tough because there weren't that many people from that regionally who were actually on the album. But Liz James, who was on the album, was there, so she was part of it. And I ended up getting Daedalus, who was doing his own set. I asked him if he wanted to sit in, and he was like, yeah, you know, he was totally into it. And my friend Lars Gottrich, who came and played acoustic guitar on it, and it was really beautiful, you know. And so that really got me excited about because the spirit of Twilight was in that performance,
right.
You know.
Right.
So it got me really excited. I ended up doing it in San Francisco, and then I got a grant to do it in Austin. which was amazing. I mean, that experience was absolutely incredible.
So, but just let's back up for 1 second on that first show that you did in Georgia, right? You're basically conducting, right?
That's right. So
you're basically conducting.
I'm up there with this lighting box. Mm-hmm. All the musicians have a light assigned to them. The show is done in total darkness. and I'm up there with just an acoustic guitar.
And are you playing the recording of the storm?
Yes. So, yeah. I really didn't articulate any of that. So the sound of the rain and the storm from the original album is playing in the background. Uh-huh. And the live performance is the same 39, 40 minutes that the album is.
Right.
So in the album, where you have different people kind of coming in and out and things sort of converging and these sort of like instant ensembles of people sort of playing together that was never intended for that to be the case, the same thing happens in the live setting because I will basically go through the ensemble beforehand, write up a loose chart of the combinations that I want of musicians. And then I'll also tell each of the musicians different things. So some of them I'll lie to, and I'll say, like, well, I don't want anybody playing anything loud, you know? But then one or two people I'll say, like, at one point I want you guys to get really loud, you know? Some people, I'll just tell them different things, you know? I'll kind of manipulate the situation a little bit. Because if you tell everybody in an ensemble, hey, at one point I want you to play something loud, well, then you have something loud being played all throughout the piece.
Right.
But if you can sort of consolidate it.
Right. So this section...
It's sort of organized chaos.
Right,
you know?
Right. I totally understand. So then, okay, after this performance is over, what was the audience reaction?
Well, the reaction in Athens was really encouraging. I mean, I don't get nervous very often performing, but I was nervous doing Twilight because, you know, there's more moving parts to that than most of my performances. I'm most comfortable... Like, I Heart Lung is so simple for me. It's just drums and guitar.
Right.
If I'm not doing something, Tom is doing something, you know, or vice versa.
Well, you also have this real solid relationship, this trust between
Absolutely.
The two of you. This language that you have that you can almost work on like an intuitive level because
right.
you've worked so closely for so
right.
long that it's like one brain almost,
That's right.
you know.
Yeah.
But with this circumstance, there were a lot of people on the stage with you.
Some of them, one person, Aaron Jolly, who played trombone at that first performance, I had never met him before. You know, much less played with him, much less heard him play.
And I'm sure he had no idea, really, of what the piece was.
Right, yeah. I mean, I explained it to him, like, in about, you know, I had, like, a little meeting beforehand, I had, like, 3 or 4 minutes, and I was like, hey, so here's what we're going to do, you know? But as things sort of progressed, I've gotten a lot better at ensuring the articulation of all of the ideas that I want to sort of be communicated mm-hmm. through the piece.
Right.
New York was, I mean, so Austin was incredible. I mean, an absolutely stellar group of musicians. I mean, it would seem to go without saying. I mean, Austin is such a music city.
Was this part of South by Southwest?
No.
That's just a separate?
Yeah, there's an organization out there called Church of the Friendly Ghost, and they put these really well-curated shows together. And there's a really beautiful venue out there called the Salvage Vanguard Theater, and that's where we did it. So I had two nights. The grant that I received required that I do an open rehearsal to basically talk to the audience about what was going on, you know? So it's like I had to communicate with them and say, hey, this is what the piece is about, you know? And that was great because I received the grant through Meet the Composers, through uh-huh. the MetLife Foundation. And that was really amazing because I basically had 3 days. I had a day to set up, I had a day to rehearse, and then I had a day for the open rehearsal, and then I had a day to actually perform. And I couldn't have felt more comfortable, you know what I mean? Like, you know, most shows, you get there and you have to, like, start setting up, start playing. You right. know what I mean? Here I had, like, you know, let's say, like, a Tuesday night, I just drop all my stuff off and start setting up. Wednesday I come in early and I keep setting up, and there's two sound people, there's two engineers working, doing the audio. And then, you know what I mean? Then we do the rehearsal. And again, for that, I totally did not play any of the things that I was going to play in the final piece because I didn't want any of the musicians to sort of anticipate what I was going to do. I wanted it to really be legitimately new to them, you know?
Right.
And I didn't even play the rain sounds in the background, you know? I was master manipulator, you know?
Well, I'm sure that all of those things, all those choices that you made along the way were designed to generate the final product on the
that's
last
right.
day, you know?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's really what you're doing is you're helping people come to the place where they can have the liberation to be creative in their own right, but within the context
that's right.
of your
absolutely
keys.
And that's why getting the right musicians is so critical.
So now how did that work in Austin? I mean, were there all these people that you knew in Austin that you just called up and said, hey, come and do this? Or were there people there helping you? Well, I need this clarinet
player. Yeah, it was a combination. Basically, one of the people who helped me set the whole thing up was Chris Cogburn, who runs a festival out there every year, which is an amazing festival, the No Idea Festival. And he helped me. He was the one who helped write the grant proposal. And then I called my friend Nick Hinnies, who plays drums in the Weird Weeds, which are a band on Sounds Are Active. And so I told Nick, here's what I'm thinking. Here's some of the instruments that I want. And he was like, okay. He's like, well, I can play vibraphone. And I was like, perfect. And then he got Steve Bernal to play cello, who's an unbelievable musician. I wanted to get Bill Baird, who was a singer-songwriter, was also in a group called Sunset. And he was able to, he had a lot of connections to a lot of these people. And then I got my friend Diane Cluck, who performed at the Next to Last Festival in Athens, but didn't participate in the ensemble afterwards. She said, if you do this again, let me know. So I did. And her boyfriend Ken drove down from New York. they kind of just spent a couple of days in Austin, you know, to kind of coincide with this. And it was incredible. You know what I mean? John Doyle on clarinet, like an amazing jazz, like ragtime clarinetist. I mean, every single part of that ensemble was so complimentary, and there was such a nice balance. And then when I did it in New York recently, that was like, it was just like, you know, like Dream City, you know what I mean? It was like Nick Rossi plays with Philip Glass Ensemble, is playing piano, and Chad Taylor, who plays with, you know, Chicago Underground Orchestra, and Iron and Wine, and Sam Prekop is like playing drums. It's like, again, Diane Cluck played in that setting, and it was just on and on, you know? And then we did two sets for the one in New York. We did that at John Zorn's venue, The Stone. And
right.
We did like an 8 o'clock set and a 10 o'clock set. And for the 10 o'clock set, we added Gray Gersten on electric guitar, which was great. But it was the sort of thing that I'm kind of still on cloud nine from that, I think. You know what I mean? I'm just so grateful for those people to have participated.
Right.
And then I recorded that. I actually took all of my gear out to New York, and I recorded that, both of those sets. And then thankfully I was able to find an audio engineer out there, a guy named Jeff Simmons, who helped me set everything up that night and ran the levels, because we basically had 2 hours to set up an entire live recording and the live sound for the performance.
Right, right.
I mean, it was like that. I mean, before I even knew it, they were like, can we open the doors? And I was like, no, don't open the doors yet, you know?
Uh-huh.
And both the seatings were sold out, standing room only.
And then, okay, so, you know, New York can be a great place to play, but again, did people know about the album coming in? Had they heard it? I mean, were they aware of what you were doing? I'm kind of curious, because it's such an interesting thing that there's this structure, but within that structure, nothing's ever the same.
Yeah.
You know, yet you're evoking something that's the same, you know?
Yeah, and I think, you know, that comes from having the right atmosphere, the right space, and getting the right people. And then the fact that I'm controlling when they're playing and what combinations they're playing in, I think that's so similar to the spirit of the record. Because on the recording, I'm crossfading a piano with a drum kit, and I may cut the piano out, and so it's just drum kit for a second, and then maybe two other, three other things come in, and they interact with the drums, and you know what I mean? there's so many different combinations, and it's this beautiful way for me to sort of like in real life articulate what normally I have to do in the studio,
right.
You know, and it's totally exhilarating.
Well, and the funny thing too is that, you know, you're not controlling the sound, you're controlling the musician.
That's right.
You know, that you're giving the musician visual cues through the light
That's
fader
right.
that you have, and encouraging them to step up when their light goes on. And it must be a fascinating experience, because all of the components that you used on the CD were created independent of each other.
Right.
But when you have talented musicians on stage next to each other, you can't separate out that dynamic. You know
yeah.
what I mean? People listen. That's what good
yeah.
musicians do.
Well, and that's one of the other things that I'll tell certain people is sometimes I'll tell, you know, let's say, you know, one of the people in the ensemble, I don't want you to listen to what anybody else is doing. Do whatever you would do as if you were the only one playing, you know? And other people will say, hey, you know, sometimes I want you to compliment. Sometimes I want you to antagonize. You know what I mean? Because that's the way that things came together on the album.
Mm-hmm.
Some things are totally complementary, and some things are kind of like fighting with other sounds for space, you know? So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to putting one together in L.A. I'm really hoping that... I'm just kind of waiting for the right venue to open up.
What would be the right venue?
A small theater. It's a Rush.
I guess.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Old Rush, too.
Oh, first album.
Yeah,
Rush.
Yeah.
Best deal day. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I was thinking about doing it at the Art, but that might be a little bit too big. It might be.
Oh, really?
It might be a little bit too big.
Okay.
I mean, you know, the best ones so far, New York and Austin, were very tight. I mean, in New York, there were literally people... We ran out of chairs. And there were people sitting behind the ensemble. So, you know, we had, like, all these people in front of us. And then there were literally, maybe, I don't know, 10 or 15 people behind us.
Mm-hmm.
Who had a totally different experience, no doubt, you know? I was thinking about the Art for a long time, and if that works out, that'd be great, but I think it's also pretty expensive to rent that place out, and this is not a big money-making endeavor, and I'd really like to keep it as sort of... I want to keep the focus on the music.
Right.
And
right.
I did you know, the 40 Bands, 80 Minutes film.
Right, yeah, that was an amazing accomplishment.
Thank you.
I mean, I don't know if people understand what you're talking about. 40 different bands
right.
performed live
right. For 2 minutes each.
In one venue.
In
the course of 80 minutes. It really... I wish I was there. I wasn't there, but you documented it really well.
Yeah, I mean, Sean Carnage is the filmmaker. He was the one who directed the film, and it was his concept. And he invited I Heart Lone to come play. And as soon as I was there and saw it, I was like... Okay, this is electric. You know what I mean? Like, I Heart Lung played, and people were like, ah! And I was like, whoa, we, like, just stepped into some sort of alternate universe or something. I mean, the things that we're doing, like, people are really into it, you know? But
For 2 minutes,
you know? And then it's move on to the next group, you know? But we did the film premiere for that at the Electric Lodge out in Venice. And I thought about possibly doing the Twilight and Ghost Stories performance at the Electric Lodge.
Mm-hmm.
If I can work it out. The big thing right now is schedules. Because
right.
I'd like... There's a couple of larger, you know, more popular individuals that I'd like to ask to participate. That I need to make sure that things work out with their schedules before I set anything in stone.
Like who?
Well, I'd like to ask Nels.
Sure.
I've talked to him about it a little bit. I'd like to get Mike Watt to participate. I've kind of talked to a lot of other people who are all kind of like, yeah, we're, you know, just let us know when. But I really want everything to sort of fall into place so that, you know, I'm always busy. I'm always working on stuff.
Right.
And it'd be nice for me to have a little bit of time to really enjoy it.
Right.
Instead of like, okay, like I just got done with this other big project and now I have to like, feeling like it's a burden or an obligation. I mean, these things are only going to happen once. I mean... The one in New York, never going to happen again. Austin, I mean, none of them. I mean, I've sort of been approaching it like, well, once I do this LA performance, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm done. Twilight Ghost Stories Live is never going to happen again.
Right.
it's, you know, close that book, that chapter's done, you know, right. Move on to the next idea.
Well, and you know, that's totally okay. I mean, because it's, you're going to, the next idea will, is, if not already, is, will be soon waiting in the wings.
Yeah.
And, you know how it is. You have to kind of midwife things into
sure.
existence.
Yeah.
And if you're pulled in all these different directions, it's really hard to do that, you know, so.
Definitely. Yeah, and it's something that, the aesthetics of the entire process are very important to me. And that sort of goes back to the whole label. I mean, I'm all about, like, the artwork needs to feel right. The music's got to feel right. You know, I don't normally put, titles or lettering on covers of the Sounds Are Active releases, because I look at it like, I mean, would any visual artist want any, you know, something obscuring their art? Or a photographer, would they want something plastered over?
Right.
I mean, when they're taking a picture, they're painting or drawing something or designing something. It's that clean, you know, kind of holistic approach to their craft that I want to preserve. And that goes for the music, the art, you know, to the website, to, you know, the experience that people get when they download something. So, like, you know, we have it so you can download CDs and or you can buy a CD or vinyl on the Sounds Are Active website and you immediately get a download of the audio.
Oh, and that worked.
Yeah.
Seamlessly.
And it's really important. I mean, yeah. I kind of want the process to be as simple and kind of like feel as good as possible, you know?
Well, I was actually knocked out by how smoothly that went.
Yeah.
You know? Because you never know.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
But, no, that was perfect.
Yeah,
perfect.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. But, I mean, all of those things are important to me, you know what I mean? And I think Sounds Are Active has sort of been my vehicle to be sort of like obsessive compulsive about aesthetics, you know what I mean? To be just totally neurotic about how everything feels and looks and what kind of paper it's on and what the packaging is going to look like.
But you know what? You have to make all of these decisions anyway.
Right.
And
yeah.
So you might as well actually make them and not just sort of hand them off or gloss over them.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you're going to do it, you might as well do it.
Yeah, do it right.
Yeah.
You know, or at least have a vision, you know, and I've sort of had one from the beginning. You know, I mean, even that first Create record, that Moth Nor Rust record, is in that weird sleeve.
Which I still have.
Yeah. That's awesome. And I love those sleeves because they actually like clean CDs on the way in and out. It's very like kind of like utilitarian, but
right.
It's like, oh, this is interesting. It's just a sleeve, you know? And the artwork is really simple, just two squares, you know, you just poke them in there. And, you know, with the Nels and GE record, with Elevating Device, it's, again, it's just a sleeve. It's just like almost like an LP style sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
No text on the front, just Matthias's artwork, and on the back, credits, details. That's it. Take the CD out. No extra junk. You know what I mean? It's just that. You know.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, one of the nice things is it's there's not that much information to convey.
Right.
You know, because it's just the two guys
yeah.
and the people that worked on the production and. You know.
Yeah, and the credits for the label and
right,
whatnot.
Right.
Yeah,
so.
But yeah, we're like with Twilight, and it's got a booklet, you know what I mean, and a timeline, and you know what I mean. There's a lot of stuff to talk about with that, but
right.
you know, each project is different.
Right. So. Excellent. Well, I'm really excited. When is the actual CD coming out?
In September.
Do you have a date?
I think it's the second Tuesday of September. Let me double check here.
He's checking out his iPhone. He's flicking through to his calendar. And
let's see.
He's in September?
I want to see September 8th.
September 8th.
Yeah, September 8th, 2009.
Well,
you can purchase it, you know, you can purchase the pre-sale now. You'll get the download of the audio today, and then I'll mail out the CDs when we get them in.
Right. And the MP3, I know that the CD is going to sound way better, but the MP3 is fantastic. It sounds really good.
That's great.
The interplay between the two guys is amazing. You can tell that they're both fully focused on what they're doing and on listening to each other.
Yeah.
And you know, that it's all improvised. It's completely, you know, in that moment,
yeah.
know, creation.
That's
you
right.
know? And I'm really excited for people to hear it, you know, because, you know, these are two great artists as
yeah,
well.
I mean, I consider them both to be kind of legends, you know what I mean, of their, you know, in their communities and what they've accomplished. These aren't guys just, you know, who are picking up, you know, a guitar and some effects and were like, oh, I think I'll mess around for a little while, you know. They have a very, like, specific voice that they've each created over right. a long period of time, you
right.
know, 20, 30 years, you know.
Right, right.
And, you know, I'm always interested in obviously bringing people from different communities together. I mean, that's one of the things I love about Twilight, one of the things I love about running the label, introducing people from different disciplines to one another, and then also bringing people of different ages together, because there's all these things that are sort of divisive in our society. It's like there's this ageism, obviously racism, class, you know, separates people, and I'm just always interested in kind of like creating dialogues between different people from different experiences and backgrounds.
Right.
And I think it's really important that, you know, you have two people who have kind of gone in all these different directions in their careers, and now they're kind of like setting, almost like they're setting that aside, but then also using all their experience to create something new together, to challenge each other, to complement one another. And I think that's an important thing to, you know, to listen to and appreciate.
Well, thank you very much. I really, really appreciate your work, and I appreciate talking with you.
That's my pleasure.
And I hope the CDs sell.
Fly off the digital shelves.
Yes, yes. All right, thanks, man.
No problem. Take care.